And joining us on the book club today is Dr. Megan Kate Nelson. Professor Nelson is an author, historian. Her latest book, The Three-Cornered War, The Union, the Confederacy, and Native Peoples in the Fight for the West. Dr. Nelson, thank you so much for being with us here today.
Well, thanks for having me, Louie. It's great to be here.
May I call you Megan or Kate?
Yes, Megan.
Megan, okay. So tell us a little bit about your background, because you are no stranger to the West and Colorado and Texas Tech.
That's right. I grew up in Colorado, and one of the things that really interested me when I started to think about Civil War history is that as I was growing up in Colorado, I had never heard about any of these battles occurring in New Mexico. I had no idea that Colorado soldiers engaged in those battles and had a hand in the Union victory. And didn't really know, you know, we learned about the Indian Wars, but it was usually part of a later process, kind of later in the 19th century. So when I started to really dig into this project, this was one of the things motivating me, because I, you know, had always been interested in history, and, you know, my father in particular had kind of taken us around on driving trips on vacations, and we used to joke that we needed a bumper sticker on the car that said, "We'll break for historical markers," because that's exactly what we would do, sort of screech to a halt by the side of the road. So I'd always been interested in history because of that. But, yeah, there's this whole kind of blank space where this history should be. And so I wanted to kind of understand what the whole conflict was about, but then I also wanted to understand why we don't know more about the Civil War West.
And a lot of times when people read about the Civil War, hear about the Civil War, and I think probably the historians that most people are associated with when it comes to Civil War are Bruce Carlson and Shelby Foote, if I left anybody else out. Those are the two main ones that come to mind, of course. Now you. But when they think of the American West, they think of the fight of the O.K. Corral. They watch movies, and it's usually after the Civil War, and some of the gunfighters or lawmakers there have been previously fought for the Confederate or the Yankees. And when you open up your book, you start off with the first summer of the Civil War, and people who live here in the Southwest area will automatically recognize some of these names, and they're going, "Wait a minute. I didn't know that was happening." For one thing, you mentioned Fort Bliss right off the bat.
Yes. Very important place in the history of the Civil War West, and particularly in the first kind of move on the part of the Confederacy to try and invade New Mexico territory. Fort Bliss was the furthest west kind of federal military installation that had been given up in the spring of 1861. And so the very first move that the Confederates made came under John Robert Baylor, who is part of the Baylor family, after which Baylor University is named. And he was in San Antonio. He brought about 300 men who he had recruited, and they put him in charge of the 2nd Texas Mounted Rifles. And his job was to march along the San Antonio-El Paso Road, which was a pretty well-worn commercial road, mail road. And at this point, it became kind of military thoroughfare. And so Baylor took about 1,000 men of the 2nd Texas and went from fort to fort on that road. And just so your listeners kind of have a sense of what that was, it was Route 90, today's Route 90 west from San Antonio, and then it kind of hooked north and followed pretty much the route that we have today of Interstate 10. At Fort Stockton all the way to El Paso. And so he and his men were on horseback, and they rode that entire road, and he was posting men along the way, but the ultimate goal was Fort Bliss, which was, you know, out there right on the western border of Texas and then also the border of Mexico, and the furthest west at that point that the Confederacy reached. That was its kind of far western border. So John Baylor got there in the summer of 1861, and he was supposed to stay there. But John Baylor was an impetuous and ambitious man, and he was also pretty paranoid, and he heard that Union troops were coalescing along the Rio Grande to kind of defend against this Confederate invasion. And so he, after resupplying his men and resting a little bit at Fort Bliss and in what was then called, I mean, it's today's El Paso as we know it, but it was called Franklin then. But they were at Fort Bliss, and they just went north, and they crossed the border into Union territory and basically executed the first invasion of Northern Territory in the war on behalf of the Confederacy.
And tell us, Megan, why was the area so important for the South to take over and so important for the Union to control?
Sure, yeah. The reason that the North and the South were so interested in the West was first for its gold mines, because it's extremely expensive to fight a war. And the South in particular did not have the kind of treasury that the North did at the time, and so they were really looking to take control of those gold mines. The South also needed the Pacific ports, particularly in Southern California, but they would have taken any of the Pacific ports, because already in the summer of 1861, the Union blockade was starting to work, and so they were being kind of shut out of their ports in the Atlantic and the Gulf. And if they could march an army from Fort Bliss all the way across what was then New Mexico territory, which extended from the Rio Grande all the way to California, so Arizona didn't exist quite yet, if they could march all that way and then march into Southern California and occupy it, then they would have access to all of these ports that they could then ship their cotton out of and, again, pay for the war effort. There's also a kind of little discussed element of this, which is that when Confederates were thinking about the future, the West was part of that future. They wanted to establish a continental empire of slavery, and they envisioned this sort of migration West and this, you know, Atlantic to Pacific Confederate nation, and from there they thought they were going to then invade Mexico once again and expand that empire into Central Latin America and also the Caribbean. So they had all of these needs and desires, and of course the Union wanted the gold and the Pacific ports also, and they really needed to keep those out of the hands of the Confederates. And for them, the West was part of their vision too of the future. They saw it in the opposite way, which was a land of free labor, so that it would be an entire continent of basically free white farmers. And so, and perhaps then later in the war, freed black farmers. But they, a land without slavery, basically. And this had been the vision for them and for Northerners and for the Republican Party, you know, in the 1850s. And this is also something that has always interested me about this topic, is that, you know, when we think about the Civil War, as you've said, you know, when we talk about the run-up to it, there's all this debate and argument about the West. I mean, the 1850s and the rise of the division between these two regions is all about the West. It's all about the Western territories. And yet, like, Civil War historians tend to, once the war begins, once the firing on Fort Sumter happens, it's like the West doesn't exist at all. Which is just peculiar, because they continued, both Northerners and Southerners, you know, the Lincoln administration and the Jefferson administration, or the Jefferson Davis administration, continued to care about the West.
We're visiting with Professor Megan Kate Nelson. She is the author of the book, The Three-Cornered War, The Union, the Confederacy, and Native Peoples in the Fight for the West. As we open the book and the reader starts going through it, you take us through what you already explained a little bit about John Baylor and coming to Fort Bliss. But then as they ride into Mesilla, they are greeted by what are most of them are Hispanos or Mexican people, and they're cheering for them.
Yeah, and this is interesting, because a lot of people, you know, when they hear about this, they're like, why did the Confederates even think that they could get this done, right? With an army of only 3,000 men, ultimately, how were they going to conquer the entire West? And part of what they thought is they knew that a lot of these communities, especially in southern New Mexico territory, sort of Mesilla and then Tucson, and also then even further west in Los Angeles, that these were communities that were pretty evenly divided between secessionists and unionists. And the reason for that is because in the 1840s and 50s, all that migration of Americans into this new territory that had been acquired from Mexico, they were coming from both the North and the South. So all of these mining towns and all of these towns and cities across the West were really up for grabs in the summer of 1861. And the Texans, under both Baylor and then later Henry Hopkins Sibley, thought that it would be pretty easy to take these towns. And in fact, it was pretty easy in Mesilla. There was a pretty large contingent of Anglos who were secessionists and Southern leaning. And then the Hispanos who were there, some were pretty invested in keeping the Anglo secessionists happy because they were business owners and farmers, and it was to their benefit to supply and continue getting the business of their fellow residents in Mesilla. Some, it would turn out, in Mesilla and then also further north in New Mexico Terry, some Hispanos, the Texans thought that they would come along with the Confederacy because they thought, well, here's a group of people, they're citizens of the United States, but they are recent citizens, and they might be feeling a little bit of resistance toward the federal government and might want to take this opportunity to break free of the United States. But what they didn't really remember is that Texans had invaded New Mexico once before in 1841, and that had not gone well. And most of the men who had arrived in Santa Fe as part of that invasion had been arrested and marched to Mexico City. Many of them died along the way. And so there was a real deep-seated, continuous anger toward Texans. And so a lot of Hispano-New Mexicans were like, why would we ever go with you? And that was a huge miscalculation on Henry Sibley's part, because he really thought this was going to go well for him. And in the town of Mesilla, it did go well. Baylor was able to occupy that town fairly easily and establish it as the newly created capital of the Confederate Territory of Arizona.
So when they captured Mesilla, because John Baylor decided that if he could capture Mesilla, as you mentioned earlier, the Confederates could control access to these mines in Santa Rita, Cobre, Silver City, that area.
Yeah, I mean, and that was part of their goal, was to start posting men, all along the Butterfield Overland Mail Route, which extended from Mesilla all the way west through Apacheria, through Chiricahua Apache territory, to Tucson, and then from Tucson to Los Angeles. And that was the plan. The plan was to establish that point of contact and that kind of foothold, and then to move small groups of Southern soldiers westward that way, to kind of strung out along the road to control it. And then once the larger army arrived from San Antonio, then that army could fight both the Union and then also Native peoples who were along that road and take control of it completely. And that part of the Southwest not only would give them access to all of those mines in New Mexico, but also all the mines of California, and then they could use that as a springboard to perhaps invade the rest of the West.
We're visiting with Professor Megan Kate Nelson. She is the author of the book, The Three-Cornered War, The Union, the Confederacy, and Native Peoples in the Fight for the West. And this is the history of the Civil War, in the Old West. I'm not sure if you could call it the Civil West back then, correct?
No, not at all.
One of the things that you write about that caught my attention to in the book is you write that Mexico had abolished black slavery in 1829, but Hispanos in New Mexico had been embracing a forced labor system enslaving Apaches and Navajos. Now, my question is, some people would say, I wasn't aware that Mexico had even had black slavery prior to 1829.
Yeah, they didn't have it very extensively. And I think part of the move on Mexico's part there was to try and prevent this really huge influx of migration from Texas. Already there had been all of those conflicts between Tejanos and Mexicans over control of land and enslavement, and I think that was part of their attempt to really exert a little bit of control over Texas. And, of course, then Texans reacted to that by rebelling from Mexico and separating themselves. And then ultimately applying to be annexed by the United States and coming in as a slave state. So That, I think, was part of their strategy there. It was not so much that there was extensive black slavery in Mexico, but there was this very extensive regional economy in captives and enslaved people that Mexicans engaged in, that New Mexicans living kind of in the most northern reaches were raiding Apache and Navajo communities in order to get mostly women and children. The trade was mostly in all of these communities in women and children because they were the most useful kind of workers in a sheep-based economy, which is what was evolving during the very early 19th century and then into this period of the Civil War. So there were these huge sheep ranches, and children were often the sheep minders, as were women, and women then often took charge of the shearing of the sheep and the making of of the wool into textiles. And so this was the basis of a very large regional economy, and it provided, the system of enslavement really provided some problems for the Union Army once they established control in New Mexico.
We're visiting with Professor Megan Kate Nelson. She is the author of the book, The Three-Cornered War, The Union, the Confederacy, and Native Peoples in the Fight for the West. You have in your book different chapters dedicated to different characters, and you focus on, I think it was 9 characters in the book that I counted. And we've been talking about John Baylor, but since we decided to talk a little bit about the Navajos and the Apaches, let's jump a little bit to War Chief Mangas Coloradas, or Red Sleeves. He was a war chief, Apache, but in one portion of the book where you describe where he's going to help raid Mexico, that he says that he just hates Mexican people.
Yes, that was the relationship between Chiricahua Apaches and Mexicans in this region, which is kind of what we know now as kind of southern New Mexico and then kind of going over into southern Arizona, you know, between Tucson and Mesilla. And that was a very long-standing relationship, again, kind of based in this economy of raiding and trading. And when you look at Mangas Coloradus' relationship, especially with a town, a kind of borderland town like Janos, it becomes really interesting. I mean, this was part of the research that I found fascinating. I was fairly new to Native American history and to borderlands history, and so to see this relationship evolve where sometimes they were at war and sometimes they established peace relations and traded together, sometimes the war was a sort of raiding war where they just attacked one another's towns and ranches and siphoned off animals and maybe took some people to enslave. Other times, it was a really vicious cycle of revenge that perhaps the citizens of Janos had, you know, betrayed the Chiricahua Apaches in a peace parley and killed some of their men, and so then there was a retaliatory strike. So there was this very long-standing relationship that was based in violence, but also in the economy. And Mangas Coloradus, I mean, what I find most remarkable about him is by the time readers meet him in the Three-Cornered War, he's 70 years old, and he's still a war leader. And that's just extraordinary, not only from because the average lifespan, you know, is probably 20 years less than that, but he's also engaging in warfare on a very regular basis. He was often injured. And the fact that none of those injuries ever got infected and killed him, and the fact that he never, you know, contracted an illness that killed him is really remarkable. And he retained his standing in the tribe and was a war leader and a leader of 2 different bands of the Chiricahuas, you know, into his early 70s. And that is just amazing. And part of the reason he was so successful is that he did actually have a pretty nuanced and kind of diverse approach, first with the Spanish and then with Mexicans and then with the Americans who came into his territory starting in the 1840s, where he would just judge the situation and then take action. So sometimes he was a diplomat, sometimes he was a war leader, sometimes he was, you know, just sort of retreated to the mountains, to his stronghold and farmed. But it's important to note that that Apacheria, the territory that Chiricahua Apaches claimed, crossed the border into Mexico. And part of that land was land that Mexicans also claimed. And then after 1848, it was land that Americans claimed. So this is also one, there are a lot of different meanings of the title of the book, The Three-Cornered War, and this is one of them, in that there are Americans and Mexicans and Chiricahua Apaches engaged in this three-cornered war for control of the border.
Is it safe to say that the Apache Wars were like 1849 to like 1880s, late 80s?
Yes. I mean, that's generally, I think most historians would say that the main part of it was 1860s to 1880s, but what I'm trying to do in the book is to really make the point that the Civil War is a real watershed moment. It's a moment that changes everything in a lot of different contexts in the Civil War West, and one of the reasons it changes everything in terms of the Apache Wars is that the Union Army, once they, you know, sent the Confederate Texans back to Texas, turned their attention to Apaches and Navajos and you know, initiated campaigns against them. And as part of that, they lured Mangus Coloradus into a parley and then killed him while he was in custody. And one of the regimental surgeons of the 1st California had his body excavated and cut off his head and boiled it down to a skull and kept it in a trunk in his tent for the rest of the war and then sent it to a phrenologist for analysis. And these two things, the kind of betrayal of Mangus Coloradus in that peace parley and then his decapitation, which was incredibly offensive to Chiricahua Apaches who believed that you go to the next world with the body that you have when you die, that really launched the central Apache Wars that we kind of know more about with Geronimo and Cochise in the 1860s and 70s and into the early 1880s.
One of the things that some people might find surprising, too, is when you describe Mangus Coloradus in your book, the size. People are probably, you know, amazed that he was 6'4".
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was a very tall man. He was very big. But he had a huge head, which is part of the reason why the surgeon wanted, you know, to kind of see his skull, because, you know, during this time, that was one of the scientific approaches to understanding people's personalities, was to look at their skulls and the parts of their heads and how big their heads were. And everyone remarked upon that when they saw him, and they were very impressed with his physicality. And again, you know, think about this, that he's 70 years old, and he is, you know, still hale and hearty. He is not a frail old man. He is still engaged in warfare, and even during this moment when he is captured and taken prisoner, he had a terrible wound that he sustained at the Battle of Apache Pass with Union soldiers of the 1st California, but he had recovered from that, which is kind of amazing. And in fact, he had surgery in Janos. So this Anglo doctor, apparently living in Janos, had operated on him and saved his life. So it's remarkable the kind of inner connections and the wide-ranging mobility of so many of these communities in this region. And I think Mangus Coloradus, you know, he became a war leader for several different kinds of reasons. But one of them is that he was so kind of physically intimidating and powerful.
We're visiting with Professor Megan Kate Nelson. She's the author of the book, The Three-Cornered War, The Union, the Confederacy, and Native Peoples in the Fight for the West. You introduce us to two ladies in your book. One of them is Louisa Hawkins Canby. Tell us about her.
Louisa Canby was a really fascinating woman. She had grown up in Indiana, had gone to college and graduated from college in Kentucky, and during that time met a young man named Edward R.S. Canby, who, and his middle name is actually Richard, and she called him Richard from their first acquaintance all the way through their marriage. And Canby, Richard Canby, was in the military academy at West Point, and he graduated, and they got married. And basically for the next 20 years, she became an army wife. She joined him at almost every single posting. He fought in the Mexican-American War, and she didn't go with him then, but that was really the only campaign in which she was not with him, stationed at a garrison or a fort. And they went together to all kinds of places in the West. They were in Monterey, California, when that state was brought into the Union. They were in Utah during the Mormon War. And then they were posted in New Mexico in 1860. And Richard was kind of second in command, but the first in command there resigned to join the Confederacy after Fort Sumter. And so he took control of the Department of New Mexico. And I really wanted her to be one of the protagonists of the Three-Cornered War because she gives readers the civilian viewpoint of a lot of the war actions here between the Union and the Confederacy. So she is waiting in Santa Fe when Richard takes his troops down to go fight with the Confederates. At Belverde, she's actually in the city when the Confederates arrive and occupy it. And then she nurses soldiers, Confederate soldiers, after the Battle of Glorieta, including one of the other protagonists, Bill Davidson. So I wanted to be able to get her viewpoint in there and then also to be able to talk about the role of women in these battlefield situations when the battlefield really becomes the home front.
Interesting about Bill Davidson that you just mentioned, he thought that the Confederacy could whip the Yankees in time to be home for Christmas dinner.
Davidson, I chose him for a couple of different reasons, but one of the most important ones for a historian like me is that he wrote this series of accounts of his experiences during the Sibley campaign, which were corroborated by his comrades and by a host of other documents. But his accounts are really vivid, and, you know, he uses colloquial language. He's quite funny in a lot of his prose, and I think a lot of readers of the Three-Cornered War will feel kind of mixed about him because you really, really like him, and yet he was a Confederate who was fighting for slavery. He was very open about that. He was fighting for the Confederacy. He fully supported, even though he was not a slave owner himself, he fully supported that cause. And so, but yes, he gives accounts of, he basically took part in every single battle that the Union and the Confederacy fought, and every single engagement. He marched from San Antonio to Fort Bliss. He fought at Valverde and then at Apache Peñon Glorieta Pass. He was in Albuquerque and Santa Fe. And then he took part in this, you know, really long and disastrous retreat after the Confederate wagons were destroyed at Glorieta Pass. And the Texan soldiers ended up marching more than 1,000 miles back to San Antonio. So, yeah, he is someone whose viewpoint, I think, puts readers on the ground with soldiers to really understand what their experience was in this very unusual, really humongous, you know, vast expanse of high desert, which is a very unusual and different theater of the war than we're used to thinking about.
Professor Nelson, we are just about out of time. We didn't get to cover all of the characters, but is there a place where people can go online to find out more about your book and more information about you?
Yes, indeed. I have a website, which is www.megankatenelson.com. And there you can find out more about me. You can find out about the book and how you can order it or where you can buy it. And also there's a list there of my speaking engagements and links to interviews like this one.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for having me. It was great.
We've been visiting with Professor Megan Kate Nelson. She is the author of the book, The Three-Cornered War, The Union, the Confederacy, and Native Peoples in the Fight for the West. The book club is taped and produced at the KTP Studios, University of Texas at El Paso Communication Building. Our thanks to our engineer, Sam Cassiano. Our producer is Alex Dominguez. You've been tuned to the book club. I'm Louis Sines.